Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 21st of January 1923, we find out why France can't succeed, Hitler goes to the circus, a soldier complains about his superiors, a minor royal gets engaged, and some civil servants go to work. But don't worry, it's not for long. Not in this episode, for reasons of time, ignorance or sloth. There's trouble in Memel. If you don't know where Memel is, it's on the Baltic coast in modern-day Lithuania. Prior to the First World War, it had been part of Germany, and afterwards it was sort of given some sort of neutral status. I think it's one of those things where the urban population are German and the rural population are Lithuanian. Anyway, the Lithuanians don't like this, and they've invaded, and they're up against about 200 French soldiers. Otherwise, in the Irish Civil War, there have been a lot of attacks this week, a lot of bombings in Dublin and elsewhere, and quite a few executions in response by the national government. Meanwhile, in Ulster, it's gone very quiet. I'm sure they're very glad that they're fighting amongst themselves. There's also been a lively correspondence about what the new grouped railway should call themselves. I won't go into the details, but... I won't go into the details. And there's been a fog in London. This is the second of this winter. It's quite bad. Traffic slows to a stop. Everything has to go very, very slowly indeed. Anyway, but they seem to be coping. There's also been a report this week about deaths in the fog, and the death rate certainly did rise last month as a consequence. Anyway, we may come on to that at some point. I hope we do. Anyway, this week, as with last week, the big story was the French occupation in the Ruhr. Not much has gone on. There have been a few altercations. One German was shot dead as a consequence. But it has inspired a pretty good correspondence in the pages of the Times. This is from a CRV Coutts. Now, I thought with a name like Coutts, he might be related to the bank, but apparently it appears that he isn't. He is, in fact, a rather senior figure in the insurance industry. Well, that doesn't immediately imply someone who is going to have much to say about economics and politics, but, I think he's very good. Anyway, this is what he has to say. This is from Tuesday, the 16th of January. The French policy on reparations, which to us seems so obviously a matter of economics, would be merely perverse were it not entangled with another policy, the aim of which can be summed up in the word security. The French are, in fact, pursuing two incompatible policies, the one of which can only be obtained by the sacrifice of the other. They can be set out as follows. Reparation. A. It is admitted that Germany can only pay reparations to any substantial extent by the export of goods and service. That's service single, by the way. B. Germany can only export goods and services, now it's plural, to foreign countries by re-establishing her pre-war industrial prosperity. Therefore, reparations on a full scale can only be obtained by assisting, or at any rate allowing, Germany to re-establish her industrial prosperity. Security. As Germany has a population far exceeding that of France, and increasing rapidly, France must be given security against a future war of revenge. Success in modern warfare depends not only on adequate supplies of men of good fighting quality, but more and more on industrial resources, chemical, metallurgical, etc. I have to laugh at that bit because one of the problems that Germany will face in the Second World War is it doesn't have men of good fighting quality. You think of the men of children in 1923, they have been through years of shortage. That means, they don't grow as tall and as strong as they otherwise might. Also, of course, in terms of industrial resources, the thing that Germany desperately lacks in the Second World War is oil. Anyway, that's an aside. He goes on. B. If Germany is allowed to recover her pre-war industrial supremacy, she will be able, at a suitable opportunity, to wage this war of revenge against France with every prospect of success. C. Therefore, at all costs, Germany must not be allowed to recover her industrial prosperity. From several discussions which I have had with French friends, by no means extreme in their views, I am convinced that security is the dominant motive. In the desire to protect themselves from another invasion, the French will sacrifice reparations, with the almost certain ruin of their currency and finance, relying on their relative economic independence. So long, therefore, as the French can find no better method of protecting themselves against the future than the hopeless policy of using their present military strength to invade and oppress Germany, the deadlock on reparations must continue. So if you want security, you can't have reparations. And if you want reparations, you can't have security. Beneath that letter is a letter from a Professor F.C. de Sumicrast. This is what he says. Like most of your readers, I quite agree that the action which France is taking in the matter of reparations is probably unwise, so far as securing the benefits she desires to obtain. But on the other hand, I feel that most of your readers do not realise what serious grounds France has for distrusting Germany and for feeling sore at the appearance of hostility her action has called forth. Not many, I suspect, certainly few among the generation since 1870-71, know what France endured at the hands of the Germans in those days. In case you don't know, he's referring to the aftermath of the Franco-Prussian War. Germany exacted the heaviest indemnity ever known until then, and occupied a very large area of French territory besides tearing Alsace-Lorraine from France and transforming it into a German fief. Again, not a voice was heard urging a moratorium for France, not a suggestion that the payments would be made easier. France pulled herself together, and the very last savings of her people went into the pockets of the conqueror, to be used for the preparation for still another war. These memories are living today in French breasts, and it is difficult, if not impossible, for the average Frenchman to understand why Germany, who provoked and brought about this war, who laid waste utterly the richest departments, should be treated with a leniency of which she exhibited no trace when she was in the ascendant. Well, all of that, of course, is true. I suppose you could argue that in 1870 it was a shorter war. There's also the fact that German or Prussian troops, call them what you will, were on French territory, as he points out, which was not is not the case now in 1923. And the indemnity was a lot smaller. See my episode from the 8th of October, because I do go into it there. Still, I think those two letters do demonstrate the bind that France, in the interwar period, finds itself in. Meanwhile, some people are looking further ahead. This is from Monday the 15th of January. Herr Adolf Hitler, the leader of the National Socialist Workers' Party, the so-called Fascisti of Bavaria, addressed a huge demonstration at the Crown Circus, one of the largest buildings in Munich, last night. In addition, four overflow meetings had to be arranged to accommodate the crowd that had arrived from the outlying districts. You do wonder how these were organised, these overflow meetings. Now, I mean, they don't have, or maybe they do have, you know, microphones and speakers and amplifiers and things like that. Maybe that's how it's done. If it is, that's high tech, because, I mean, I have read accounts of some of the big meetings that took place at the time of the Home Rule debate in 1912. And in those cases, you would have one speaker and relays. You'd have relay speakers. I mean, another guy somewhere some distance away who could hear what the first man was saying and would repeat what he was saying. But obviously that's not what's going on. Apparently that's not what's going on here. Anyway, it goes on. Herr Hitler declared that 3 years ago he had foretold Germany's present desperate condition. Today the people were crying down with the French, but the National Socialists must also take as their slogan, down with the November criminals. That is, those who drew up the present German constitution at the Weimar Conference in November 1918. I'm not sure the Times is quite correct here. I think it's also the people who signed the armistice. Anyway, he goes on. And down with those who betrayed the fatherland. The Nationalist Socialists were organising and recruiting an army of revenge, which in the near future would restore Germany to her former greatness. In conclusion, Herr Hitler asked his supporters to return home quietly and to avoid any demonstrations in the streets. In spite of this advice, however, bands of stormtroops paraded the streets, singing the fascist war songs, and a serious attack was made on the hotel Wir Jahre Zeitzen, where members of the Allied Control Commission are quartered. What might he do next? Wednesday the 17th has a possible answer. One would have thought that with the Kuno cabinet, Kuno's the chancellor at the time, engaged on such difficult problems, all Germans who make a special boast of their patriotism would have abstained from causing difficulties at home. But there are persistent rumours that the Bavarian fascisti propose to bring about some sort of putsch on January the 20th. So do they? Well, you'll have to wait until next week's episode to find out. The fallout from the war took many forms. On Tuesday the 16th of January, the Times reported on a speech made by Field Marshal William Robertson. Now, if you don't know who this character is, he is unique in that he is the only man ever to have risen from the rank of private to the rank of field marshal in the history of the British Army. He was highly intelligent. I hope I put a link up to a lecture given by a chap called Ross Beadle on this guy. Anyway, in the war, he was between 1916 and 1918 the chief of the Imperial General Staff, which is effectively the head of the British Army. And from what I can work out, he did a very good job. Anyway, this is what he has to say. Sir William Robertson agreed that there was something to be said for the view that one could not write the history of a war until about 50 years after it had been fought. But on the other hand, he said, a good deal happened in war, which did not appear in official dispatches or in blue books. I guess that's some sort of official publication. He goes on, most of it was in men's heads. If it were not written up at the time, it might be not correctly remembered. Well, yes, there is a problem with that in that those things that are written up at the time or shortly after. I mean, memoirs are often written up, or obviously written up shortly afterwards, and they are notoriously self-serving and inaccurate. Diaries are better, but it all depends on whether someone keeps a diary or not. Anyway, he talks about an incident in late 1918. Now, by this stage, Robertson has been fired, so he has no part in this. But the British have just won the Battle of Amiens and have begun what has subsequently been called the 100 Days Offensive, which it wins the war, effectively. But at this stage, they don't know it's going to win the war. Anyway, he's preparing an attack, and the cabinet writes a memo to him. This is what Robertson has to say. It's said the cabinet would be very anxious if he, Sir Douglas, suffered many casualties, practically said that success only would justify making that attack. Well, the government are certainly entitled, I suppose, if they think a commander-in-chief is taking a wrong military action, to write him and say so, and give him an order not to do it. But I do not think they are entitled, on the eve of a great battle, when a man is carrying all the responsibility which he carries at such a time, to write him to the effect, we think you will lose, and if you do, you'll have to take the consequences. As a mean and cruel act, I don't think that incident has any parallel in our history or in the history of any other country. And now for some good news. This is from Tuesday the 16th. It is with the greatest pleasure that the King and Queen announce the betrothal of their beloved son, the Duke of York, to the Lady Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, daughter of the Earl and Countess of Strathmore and Kinghorn, to which union the King has gladly given his consent. Not that it matters much. Albert is, as they say, a spare. His brother, the Prince of Wales, is fit, healthy, and overwhelmingly popular. All he needs is a wife. The good news is that when one or other of them does become king, they need not worry that their employees are being overworked. This is from Monday the 15th of January. According to the report of the Select Committee on Estimates, which was issued last August, the hours of work during the week do not exceed 34 3/4. Civil servants attend at 10 o'clock in the morning, have 3/4 of an hour for luncheon, and leave at 5 o'clock, with the exception of Saturday, when they leave at 1:30. Yeah, people used to work on a Saturday morning. I'm not quite sure when it ended. I know schools did until, well, not in my lifetime, but they did for a long time. But civil servants did at least show up in those days. Here's a man who won't have any choice about showing up. This is from Thursday the 18th. Sentence of 6 months imprisonment in the 2nd Division was passed at Croydon Police Court yesterday on John Jacobs, 39, of London Road, Norbury, on a charge of unlawfully obtaining 24 half-grain tablets of morphine. He pleaded guilty. I don't know what the 2nd Division means. There's also a 1st, by the way, which occasionally gets used. I think it's without hard labour. I think that's what they mean here. It goes on. Mr. Sanders prosecuting said it had been found through a Norbury chemist's drug register that the prisoner who signed MRCVS after his name, I think that stands for Member of the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons, it goes on, after his name, had on 11 occasions obtained morphine. It was served to him on the strength of prescriptions he wrote out himself. His explanation was that he wanted the drug for professional work as he used it for racehorses. Jacobs told the police that he had taken morphine since 1916, having injected into his arm as much as 10 grains at a time. The effect, added Mr. Sanders, had been to warp him mentally. Mr. Conway, for the prisoner, said he was invalided out of the army through wounds received in Egypt and Gallipoli, and began taking the drug to alleviate his suffering. Interestingly enough, that's almost exactly what would happen to Hermann Göring after the putsch in, it's coming later on this year. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.